Support comes from WFAE members and Mazda of South Charlotte, committed to drivers that share Mazda's passion that cars make driving matter. More at MazdaofSouthCharlotte.com. This is Charlotte Talks. I'm Mike Collins on the local news roundup October 12th. That's the target date CMS has set for their phased-in plan to bring students back to the classroom. Corona cases appear to be declining in Mecklenburg, though health officials are worried about a Labor Day spike. Tom Tillis and Cal Cunningham meet in the first of three debates as they vie for a U.S. Senate seat in North Carolina. CMPD says it has met its police reform goals. The Huntersville pipeline leak may have been worse than previously believed. And Hurricane Sally dumps a lot of rain. Here to talk about those stories and more is WFAE's education reporter Ann Doss-Helms. Good morning to you.
Good morning.
Nick Oxner is here from WBTV, where he's executive producer for investigations and their chief investigative reporter. Nick, welcome.
That was a mouthful. Thank you.
It was. Joe Bruno. Here's another mouthful. Joe Bruno is a reporter for WSOC-TV, Channel 9, Eyewitness News. That's a lot of words.
So hard to say. Good morning.
And Jonathan Lowe is anchor reporter for Spectrum News 1. Not so hard. Hey, Jonathan. Good morning.
Good morning. I'm sunny. It's cloudy.
Okay. So CMS has been conducting online-only classes so far this fall, but there has been high anxiety here and around the country about this approach. And this week, CMS unveiled a plan to bring kids back to the classroom, and Superintendent Ernest Winston mapped it out.
We will take a phased approach that demonstrates caution, courage, and compassion.
So, Ann, what's the plan?
It is very complicated. It actually starts September 29th with students with disabilities, not every student, but some in specialized schools. October 12th, all the pre-kindergarten students come back, and they will be there by themselves for about 3 weeks. Then on November 2nd, one-third of the elementary school students will come back because they will be on this alternating, you know, one group comes in for one group week, another group for the next week. November 23rd, we get the middle school students back. And then in December, the high school students will come back for end of course testing. And I don't know that every high school student has end of course tests, so I'm still trying to figure out exactly how that plays out. But as it goes now, the high school students don't start back until January 5th for real classes, and that will only be one third of them. So the last students to actually come back to class will be that third rotation of high school students on January 18th. So people either think they rushed it too much and this is going to be dangerous and everybody's going to be sent home, or they're wondering why on earth high school students have to sit out the first semester.
Well, that was going to be my question. Why are they beginning with the youngest and moving to the oldest? Is it because the youngest students are having the most difficulty adjusting to online learning and the high school kids theoretically have more experience in education and therefore they're dealing with it better, or are there other reasons for it?
It's the costs and the benefits. I think they do feel like, yes, it is much harder for, I mean, you know, a four-year-old, five-year-old, six-year-old is not going to be doing a great job with operating Canvas and trying to learn how to read online. So yes, the younger kids are having the hardest time at home, need the in-person class the most, but also medically and socially, they're probably a lower risk. Although, you know, there's going to be some real challenges to keeping four-year-olds, you know, socially distanced, but they're saying, you know, it's the high school students, you start seeing kind of the same types of behavior that you might see at college, where we've seen some spikes. And teenagers are medically closer to adults in terms of being more likely to get and spread the virus.
And just to add to what Ann just mentioned there, also with, you know, as you get up in grade, especially by, I think, middle school, you start moving around the school, changing classes versus an elementary school student who is in one location the entire day or school day. You know, you have older students who are moving through the halls, changing classes, you know, going to club meetings and athletic events if that's part of their day as well. So I think there's more interaction with the older kids as well.
And that's going to be part of the challenge, is setting up a schedule where they're not doing that, because what you don't want is one student tests positive and all of a sudden the whole school is exposed. Right. What you want to do is keep your students in clusters that don't do a lot of mingling with others. And that's much easier to do with a first grade class than a high school student.
So a moment ago, Ernest Winston used the words caution, courage, and compassion. Caution, I understand. If this requires courage, that means that trust isn't 100% because people believe it may be risky. So why would he use that word? Why courage and compassion?
Well, I'm not a speech writer, so I don't know. It alliterates nicely. But I do think we are asking everybody to take some chances, and the teachers in particular, because even if you're teaching four-year-olds, you're still potentially exposed. And you think about even the special education teachers who are going back first. And these are, again, kids with some pretty serious disabilities where, you know, there's a lot of hands-on care that is required. So we are asking our educators, our bus drivers, you know, everybody out there to take some risks for the kids.
So at the moment, we are still not where health officials would like us to be in terms of the number they want to hit for positive cases. I think we're at 5.8% of tests coming back positive. They would like to be at 5%. So there is some risk involved in this. And I'm wondering why they chose to make this announcement at this time. Does it have to do with the lawsuit that we'll talk about that parents have filed? Was there something else going on that told them we need to start moving back to the classroom?
Well, I think they've been moving in this direction. I don't think that the lawsuit made them go, oh my gosh, we weren't even thinking about this. Now we need to do it. I think they've been, you know, CMS moves slowly and deliberately, and they've been saying from the very beginning, we need metrics. We got some metrics on the board. You know, people have been saying we want to get kids back in class. Nobody thinks it's great to be in remote learning forever. So I think this was just their process.
So CMS made this announcement earlier this week. And then yesterday, Governor Roy Cooper said that all North Carolina public school students in grades K through 5 will be permitted to transition to full in-person instruction with students and faculty wearing face masks and practicing social distancing.
As our metrics improve and as our safety protocols are installed across our state, we're able to get more students back into the classroom. That's a positive thing.
So CMS is not going to change their mind about this. They're going to continue to do what they had already announced they were going to do. They're not going back. But Ann, you mentioned before we went on the air that Iredell-Statesville School jumped on this like that, and they're going back.
Yeah, they had a press release out. You know, I think the news conference was like at 3 and it was over at 4 and maybe 5 or 6. There was a news release from Iredell-Statesville. They say, we're still working out the details, but we are ready to go back with plan A for, and they've been on a plan B already. They have the 2 days on and 3 days off. So that their elementary kids starting October 5th will be going 5 days a week.
So we have this little battle royal going on between Republicans and Democrats about opening up our economy. The Republicans want to go for it. Democrats are a little more cautious. And the same thing is happening at the state level with regard to schools. Lieutenant Governor Dan Forrest called the governor's plan to reopen schools, they called the previous plan a failure. The governor's decision to move ahead with this based on criticism and a push he's getting from Republicans in the legislature?
Hard to say, Mike, but the timing is more than coincidental, maybe. You know, literally one day the Republicans have a press conference that, although really turned more into a press conference on Dan Forrest's disdain for masks. But anyways, the point of which was to say, let's reopen schools. And then literally the next day, the governor says we're going to start reopening some schools. But I don't think this is hardly a new thing or a new realization that it's time to do something with schools.
The Charlotte
and he's never going to say that the Republicans forced me to do this. But what he did say, though, is a lot of school districts have been reaching out to his office asking for expanded capacity for elementary schools.
But at the same time, I asked Elise Dashew if they had any heads up about this, and she said no. So that the dynamics of this are weird. You have to wonder, you know, in an ideal world, the Republicans and the Democrats would all be looking at this information and coming together to say, let's open this door, let's move toward it. And then you have Governor Cooper didn't bring in Mark Johnson, the superintendent. He didn't bring in any of the education people. It's just, bam, we're reopening plan A for elementary school.
And there, of course, was a split on the Charlotte-Mecklenburg School Board. The vote was 6-3 to go ahead with Ernest Winston's announced plan. School Board Vice Chair Thelma Byers-Bailey said the return plan strikes a balance between two extremes in the community.
One that has been pounding the table saying we needed to go back to school 2 months ago. And the other who are shaking in their boots saying, no, not yet, no, not yet, no, not yet.
And the three members who voted against the plan did so because they believe it is too slow. Here's Sean Strain.
I look at this and I think to myself, why aren't we putting these kids back in our classrooms as soon as possible? It's not reckless. It's not only responsible, but it's necessary.
And Strain said that the case for continuing mandated remote learning has not been made. Where do most parents and teachers stand on this decision to go back?
I think they're all over the board. I mean, there were probably at least 4,000 people over the course of that four-hour meeting streaming it on Facebook. And if you watched the comment section, it was just moving by in a blur, and everything from what's wrong with these people that they're not just bringing everybody back right away to what's wrong with these people that they're not keeping them out longer. It's nobody has the answers.
And you know, it will be interesting to see, Mike, you know, not to play devil's advocate, but when we had schools that did start back with the in-person learning, both K through 12 education as well as higher education, we then saw spikes in cases, clusters of cases, outbreaks in some cases. And some districts, not just here in the state, but across the nation, had to shut back down. So what will be the impact, and how will large districts such as CMS respond if they then begin to see?
We have to take a break. We'll come back with more in a moment on our local news roundup. It's Charlotte Talks on WFAE. Support for Charlotte Talks comes from WFAE members and Fifth Third Bank, dedicated to the financial empowerment of the community by investing time, resources, and people in the Charlotte area and throughout the state. More at 53.com. It's Charlotte Talks on Listener Funded, 90.7 WFAE and 90.3 WFHE. I'm Mike Collins. It's the local news roundup. Hence, Ann Doss Helms is here from WFAE News. Joe Bruno from WSOC-TV. Nick Oxner from Channel 3 WBTV. And Jonathan Lowe from Spectrum News 1. Before we move on to other topics, the school board voted at 6-3 to go back to school in this phased-in approach. Member Carol Sawyer noted that the plan could be derailed if there's a fall or winter surge in COVID-19. What metrics, and will they use to make those decisions? Because they may have to reverse this decision quickly if things happen too.
Well, they've got a whole dashboard that includes a lot of factors that are internal to CMS, including if they start having to have a lot of staff who are quarantined or who are sick, then they may have to close individual schools. Or now they said, don't say close, go back to remote learning. They would still have remote, but basically they are looking at the cases per 100,000 and the positivity rate are the two big COVID numbers that they're watching. And they
so
have
if things go well, is there a possibility they could bring, they could accelerate the phase in?
I think so. I mean, I did not read the CMS statement as saying we will never, ever, ever go to plan A. I read it as saying, you know, we're not going to come into next week's school board meeting and say, let's start this over. We're moving down the path we've charted. But yeah, there's, you know, there's, like I say, there's yellow, green, and red. They're in the yellow right now on the COVID measures. If they move into red, they're going to start moving back to all remote. If they move into the green, I think it's possible that they could say, at least for elementary school, you know, maybe we go back to everybody there 5 days a week. I think that would make a lot of people really happy if this plays out safely. And one of the things that Mandy Cohen said yesterday was that the school districts that have opened on Plan B, we really are not seeing any kind of spike in student cases.
So this has become a partisan issue. COVID is very partisan all over the country. And this week, almost all GOP leaders in the state, including Lieutenant Governor Dan Forrest, called for the immediate reopening of public schools. Forrest, who of course is running for governor, was asked repeatedly for his plan.
The plan is open the schools, open the schools, open the schools. As governor, I would open schools. That would be the plan.
Forrest was also asked if the state should have any mandatory guidelines for school districts to follow if and when they reopen, and he said no. In fact, he also said this.
You really don't need a plan. You can follow people that are doing this all over the world and have done it safely, and these schools can find ways to open safely and get the kids back in the classroom.
What's more, Forrest said no students or teachers should be required to wear a mask, and he would lift the statewide order on mask wearing.
I don't think that there's any science that backs that up.
He added that this was his personal opinion, and the governor responded this way.
When elected leaders and people in important policy positions discourage the use of masks, then that becomes part of the problem.
And the statement made this week by Dr. Robert Redfield, who is the director for the Centers for Disease Control, is also in opposition to Dan Forrest's skepticism about masks. Redfield told the Senate,
"We have clear scientific evidence they work. and they are our best defense. I might even go so far as to say that this face mask is more guaranteed to protect me against COVID than when I take a COVID vaccine.
That, of course, got a almost immediate reprimand from the president, who seems to know more about science than scientists do. But Dan Forrest was pretty adamant about going back to school. This is prior to the governor's decision, prior to, I think, the CMS decision, or just after it, but of course he's running for governor, not Mecklenburg County. What has been the reaction to his push, not only for going back, but for not wearing masks? Is that simply speaking to his Republican base, or are other people on the same page?
Yeah, I think that is an effort to speak largely to his base. But Mike, you've got to look. Dan Forrest is significantly under, polling under even President Donald Trump and Senator Tom Tillis in the polls. I mean, so Forrest is likely trying to do anything he can to make up ground and, you know, move the needle in his election that, even though it's tightened some, is still, you know, quite far away in separation between him and
Is that the way to do it?
It is a way to do it.
Okay.
You know, Mike,
I
think he's catering to a small portion of his base because, you know, take a look at the Elon poll in June 2020. 74% of people support the state requirement to wear a mask. We've really largely adopted to this mandate. You don't even see a whole lot of people pushing back on it nowadays. It's really become quite common. That same poll said 46% of people always wear a mask. I don't think lifting the mask mandate is a winning issue,
Jonathan.
But I will add that we have seen, you know, just as early as yesterday, take Kentucky, for instance. There is a whole demonstration out in front of the state capitol there. I believe it's in Louisville. Correct me if I'm wrong. But yesterday, people demonstrating and, you know, in live interviews, not masked up, and digging into what we're hearing from people like Dan Forrest and the president, mm-hmm. saying, if I don't want to wear a mask, I shouldn't be required to wear one. And so there were, that was just one of the demands. Reopen was another one, but it's not this whole digging into this not being required to wear a mask is not unique to just North Carolina. I mean, it's something we're seeing across the nation.
And yeah. It is worth noting that regardless of his opinion, masks are going to be required in schools, yes. for everybody over age 5. And CMS is even making a huge order of teeny tiny little masks for its 4-year-olds. So they may not be legally required, but they are going to be putting masks on the little guys.
And that is not
all. Regardless of his opinion, the science is clear here. The masks are working.
Okay. And that is not all that CMS is doing to prepare to get kids back into the classroom. They're making what you described, Dan, as extensive preparations for that. They've stocked up on 66,000 bottles of hand sanitizer. I'm not sure that's enough. 1.3 million pairs of gloves and more than 10,000 gallons of hand soap. Not sure that's enough either. 155,000 face coverings for staff. $150,000 water bottles so that kids don't have to use water fountains. What about concerns, though, about the ventilation there? Are these schools that cannot be changed in terms of the efficiency of their air conditioning systems?
Yeah, and that's a huge debate. I think several of us were laughing on social media about what an education we're getting on HVAC systems that we didn't necessarily feel like we would ever be caring about. But there are questions about the filtration levels at all of the schools. They say that their systems are not able to accommodate the very highest level of filtration that is considered most effective in keeping the virus from circulating. But then in these, first they were saying 39 schools, now they say 36 schools and 3 other buildings, but they do not have the capability to bring in outside air. And so that's a real concern. And they talked about everything from these very low tech, well, maybe they can just kind of open the doors and the windows sometimes to bring in some outside air, to if you want to get real serious about it, don't use those buildings, don't use those schools when kids come back. And they didn't resolve that.
So there was a lawsuit filed prior to the governor's announcement and prior to Ernest Winston's announcement about phasing the schools back in. a lawsuit filed against CMS by parents demanding a return to the classroom because it was, quote, unfair to those in lower economic situations. So I understand the motivation for that suit has now come into question. The suit was filed by all white parents who say the digital divide created by remote learning particularly harms socioeconomically disadvantaged minority students. But Justin Perry, who is the co-founder of OneMEC, that's a group working for educational equity and who is black, says the racial makeup of those filing the suit did not sit well with him. If they're fighting for his constituents, why should that matter?
Well, and I want to be clear that the lawsuit was not filed just on behalf of disadvantaged kids. These parents are saying, we think being back in school is best for everybody. And yes, that includes our kids who are mm-hmm. white and who are, at least the family I talked to said, we actually put one of our kids in a private school because we don't think that that this is working for them, the remote learning. We have that option. Not everybody has that option. But they did say they feel like they are also speaking for the disadvantaged students. And it is kind of interesting because nobody really argues with the premise that the kids who are the furthest behind are being the hardest hit by remote learning in many cases. But what they're saying is they're also, in many cases, it's the black communities, the Hispanic communities, the low-income communities that are being hardest hit by the virus itself. So there is the question of, are they safer in school or at home? And simply, I think what Justin Perry was also saying is, if you'd been working with this community all along, you might have a lawsuit that would include the NAACP, that would include black families and Hispanic families. Instead, you know, it's this whole political dynamic that you see where the Republican folks stand up and hold a press conference saying, put the kids back in school. I think there is some suspicion in some quarters that this is part of that dynamic.
So as I understand it, that suit is semi on hold for whatever reason. And I'm sure that Nick could tell us what that is. But is it a moot point now that CMS has put in their phased in return to school plan?
I don't think so. The last I heard was that they were waiting for everybody to actually be served with the suit. So
okay.
A judge could schedule a hearing and say this, you know, phase in that takes until mid-January is not good enough. I'm not sure that a judge would intervene in something like this. Again, you have public health concerns that legitimately make it permissible to keep kids out of school. But I don't believe, to my knowledge, the suit hasn't been dismissed or in any way legally sidetracked.
So we are told that the number of COVID-19 cases in Mecklenburg County is on the decline. We're entering our second month of declining cases. The positivity rate, as I mentioned earlier, stands, I think, at about 5.8%. But health officials here and around the state would like, around the country actually, would like to see it at 5% before we start to seriously reopen things. And State Health Director Mandy Cohen has said that there are days when we meet that 5% goal. Mecklenburg County Health Director Gibby Harris, though, has cautioned about a potential spike in cases because of the Labor Day holiday. When will we know if there's reason for concern?
Dr. Cohen said yesterday that they need a little more time to figure out whether Labor Day had any impact on statewide numbers. So that would probably be the same thing for Mecklenburg County. I think next week we'll have a better picture at how Labor Day impacted us.
Okay. And more good news. 80% of all people diagnosed with coronavirus in Mecklenburg County, 80% have recovered and been released from isolation. Has that been the case all over the country? Or are we doing something particularly well here? Anybody know? None of you are doctors, so you may not know.
Yeah, I don't think there's a way to know, but I think that, you know, for a while now, more people have recovered from COVID-19 than actually have it in Mecklenburg County.
And yet, Joe, there was a scare when more than 6,700 people in Mecklenburg County received text messages from the county health department last Friday telling them they had tested positive. That was incorrect, I understand. What happened?
You know, I think the scare was compounded because the county originally said that this was a scam, that somebody was trying to trick everyone. And then they walked that statement back and said it was a glitch. Basically, this vendor that works with the county to help with contact tracing, they used a comma in their code. And somehow that comma threw everything off and resulted in a bunch of people getting told that they have COVID-19 when they actually do not.
Nick, you're muted.
Oh, that's my first fail today, including people. My colleague David Hodges talked to a woman who actually had been tested for COVID-19, was negative, and then got a message saying she was positive. So there are still some county commissioners who have questions about how this could happen. The county's not answering any more questions. They promised interviews with Gibby Harris and haven't fulfilled that. So it'd be great if they could actually answer some questions on this.
So our cases in Mecklenburg County are declining, even though we have the highest number of hospitalizations in the state. But unfortunately, rural counties are seeing a dramatic rise in death rates from this virus. And WBTV reported this week, Nick, that Patrick Woody, president of the North Carolina Rural Center, said he thought rural residents thought this would be a big city problem, but it showed up with a vengeance. Do we know why?
Well, if you think about, you have, as we talk about in that story, which we published from the Charlotte Observer, is that, you know, you have people with more people with health problems. You have an older population in rural areas, but you also have, previous reporting has shown, you have a lot of agriculture jobs, you have food processing jobs, and we know the virus is spreading more and faster amongst those kinds of populations. And those are largely tend to be in more rural areas. So it really shouldn't be surprising to us that we see this.
Yeah, and some of those rural, those agricultural jobs are in meat packing plants where social distancing is next to impossible. And those are the workers who are getting it.
And it's colder, which helps the virus spread faster. So the conditions are just much more ripe.
Well, it's about to get colder, but there's also hopefully about to be a vaccine, we are told. We'll talk about that and more when we come back on the Local News Roundup on Charlotte Talks on WFAE. Support comes from WFAE members and Mazda of South Charlotte, committed to Mazda's focus to ensure every element of a car is designed around the driver. More at MazdaofSouthCharlotte.com. It's Charlotte Talks on WFAE and WFHE. I'm Mike Collins. The Local News Roundup comes your way every Friday. And Doss Helms is here, education reporter for WFAE News. Jonathan Lowe from Spectrum News 1. Joe Bruno from Channel 9, WSSC-TV. And Nick Oxner from Channel 3, WBTV. The search for a vaccine for COVID-19 is underway, though mixed messaging from Washington seems to be raising issues of trust. The president is pushing for a rollout by the day before the election. Dr. Anthony Fauci is cautiously optimistic that we could have a vaccine by the end of the year. On Wednesday, Dr. Robert Redfield, head of the CDC, said a vaccine could be available in very limited supply by mid to late November or December of this year, but it would not be widely available until mid or late 2021. The president almost immediately took issue with that, saying Redfield was wrong. And that could be why polls report only 39% of Americans say they would take a Donald Trump-approved vaccine. But State Health and Human Services Secretary Mandy Cohen has more trust in the process.
I do think there is a lot more science left to do and research left to do and see. But I have heard personally from the career regulators at the FDA, heard about the process that they're using, understood the safety and efficacy metrics that they're going to be using. I feel very comfortable right now as I hear about that process.
And yesterday on this program, Dr. Dale Owen, CEO of Trion Medical Partners, where they are conducting phase 3 clinical trials for the Moderna vaccine, echoed that sentiment.
I've got a lot of faith in the science and the scientists involved, and I don't think that they're going to bow to the peer pressure to bring this up, bring this forward earlier than it should be.
I'm wondering if people believe that, given that yesterday, after that program aired, the president reportedly removed Dr. Robert Redfield and Dr. Anthony Fauci from the task force, the coronavirus task force. And now the key doctors in all of this in the country, the experts in the country, have been removed from that task force. How can we trust anything that comes out of the White House with regard to this vaccine?
Well, trusting the White House and trusting a vaccine are two different things.
But remember, the White House is pulling the levers, Nick, and you know it.
Well, no, but drug companies are manufacturing the vaccine, and I think this is an important point. If you're Moderna, for instance, you're not going to go damage your... Let's just take out the well-known and highly regarded and well-touted safety regulations that we have in this country on drugs and specifically with this vaccine. But let's just talk about from a practical standpoint, if you're a drug manufacturer, you are not going to just grossly damage and ruin your reputation forever by putting out a faulty vaccine. So we shouldn't let the fact that people are moving quickly scare us and hamper us, because we've seen all of these companies, both in the United States and across the world, working quickly and all moving in the same direction. And clearly, people have the interest of science, you know, whether or not they are really paying attention to what the White House is saying.
I think it will be key for, you know, just like we know kind of now the metrics that help determine, you know, COVID cases and reopening plans, et cetera. It will be important for whenever a vaccine is found for the public to be informed on the efficacy and the processes of making sure it's safe that Dr. Cohen just mentioned, you know, because I think part of the reason that so many say they wouldn't take a vaccine is because they don't know what's being done to make sure it's safe.
Okay. Well, I hope both of you are right. The virus also took center stage in this week's first of three debates between candidates for U.S. Senate in North Carolina, the incumbent Republican Tom Tillis and Democrat Cal Cunningham. Tillis was asked if he would get the vaccine when it becomes available and encourage his family to do so.
You bet I'll get a vaccine, like I got the flu vaccine last week, and I encourage everybody else to do the same. But only until I know that the most vulnerable population, anyone over the age of 65, people with underlying health conditions, frontline workers, law enforcement, the people who should get it first. And I think we place a priority on that. And as soon as I know that they've been protected, then I'll be standing in line.
But his challenger, Cal Cunningham, said he would be hesitant.
Historically and traditionally, I would support and have confidence in the Food and Drug Administration and the processes that they go through in order to approve a drug. But we have seen an extraordinary corruption in Washington. We have seen political and financial corruption that has intervened in and diluted and distorted decision-making in Washington, D.C. So as the senator for North Carolina, I would have a lot of questions of the FDA. I think the American people have questions.
And to which Tillis said Cunningham would be putting lives at risk if he chose not to get vaccinated. But that's the problem, isn't it? It all boils down to trust. And people already distrust vaccines in many places in the country, just ordinary vaccines that we've had on the books for years and years and years. Did anything of substance, other than that, of course, come out of this debate?
I think that was the key moment. There was more, Mike, from that debate where the moderator asked Cal Cunningham to clarify, are you saying you wouldn't get the vaccine? And he said no. And no, I think that was probably the cornerstone of the policy differences in that debate.
So you reported, Nick, this week that on $20,000 in campaign contributions from political action committees tied to pharmaceutical companies that were received by Tom Tillis within 2 weeks of sponsoring a bill related to drug prices back in 2019. This, I think, has been mentioned in an opposition TV commercial. What did you discover about this?
Yeah, we wanted to dig in specifically to see the timing and how all that timing lined up. And what we found is that Senator Tillis was an original co-sponsor on a bill in late December that addressed prescription drug prices, but notably omitted a key provision from a previously introduced bill that was introduced by Senator Chuck Grassley, another Republican that had bipartisan support, but was opposed by pharmaceutical companies. And mainly that provision would have capped drug prices to inflation. So he introduces as a co-sponsor on this bill without that key controversial component. And within 2 weeks, he receives $20,500 from a group of political action committees tied to pharmaceutical companies. I spoke with the executive director of the Center for OpenSecrets.org, the group that runs OpenSecrets.org that tracks campaign finance contributions. And she said, look, this is very unusual to see this kind of activity all at once and to see it at the end of a year where there's not an election. So we tried to ask the Tillis campaign to explain these contributions, and they wouldn't. They wouldn't give us an interview. They wouldn't give us a statement that explained it. So make of that what you will.
So politicians take PAC money all the time, and much of it comes from various different industries. And in fact, you reported that Tillis has taken the fourth most campaign contributions from the pharmaceutical industry this year, behind behind Democrats Bernie Sanders and Elizabeth Warren and the Senate Majority Leader, Republican Mitch McConnell. Does that make it wrong? I mean, is it wrong to take PAC money?
No, look, nothing in my story should be read to say that what he did was illegal. I think it raises some questions. Again, the Center for Responsible Politics executive director is the one who said it's unusual because of the timing, at a period on the calendar where people just don't normally give a lot of money, and B, in such close conjunction to legislative action, right? That's why it's worth raising the question. What I think is even more notable here, Mike, is the fact that Senator Tillis and his campaign would not answer the questions. I mean, they just won't. And when politicians of any party refuse to give any answer, I think we should all ask more questions.
So if your reporting is right, that Tom Tillis is the fourth leading recipient of campaign contributions from the pharmaceutical committee industry, does that mean that the Cal Cunningham TV commercial that says he's the leading campaign contribution getter from pharmaceuticals is incorrect?
Yeah, he's number four. I mean,
okay, he's something to shoot for. He's number four. Okay, President Trump has been warning about what he and others see as the danger of mail-in ballots, even as he mails in his own ballot, and saying that millions of unsolicited ballots have been mailed to people, which is completely false. What is true, however, is that the Mecklenburg Board of Elections mailed a double portion of ballot style 71. The president has already tweeted about this. It feeds his case. What happened?
All right. So this is only impacts about 300 ballots. Basically, a staffer mislabeled some ballots. They caught the mistake. They shredded them. They thought they shredded all of them, but it turns out they already sent out a couple of the ballots. That turned out to be about 300 of them. So 300 people in the Matthews area, not even all of Matthews, just the Matthews area, got a double ballot. It was inadvertent. It was just a mistake. It was an embarrassment, but this isn't the Mecklenburg County Board of Elections trying to rig an election.
Yeah, and that's what Michael Dickerson, the elections director, said. He characterized it as more of an embarrassment than an issue, and he said that the state system will prevent someone from voting twice. Of course, it's a felony to vote twice, despite what the president has said, urging you to do it. But if you mail in that extra ballot because it was mailed to you by mistake, what then?
So every ballot has a unique barcode on it that is scanned as soon as you return your ballot, and it marks you as voting. So you can't vote twice. That you try to send it back again, they're going to reject it.
And they have a tracker online now, so that as soon as they get it, it's, you know, you could, that barcode can be found online. So they're right on it.
You can track the fact that they have received and counted your vote online. You can do it yourself. CMPD Absolutely. Says that they have met all of their goals on police reform, which makes them compliant with the Eight Can't Wait initiative. Chief Jennings says this is just the beginning of a new era. What have they done, and what has been the reaction of the community to the announcement that they've done it all?
Well, they've met some... Sorry, go ahead, Jonathan.
I'll make it quick, Nick. This is the Eight Can't Wait initiative. It's basically eight criteria that deal with use of force. So duty to intervene, help me, Nick. I'm having a brain fart, your word.
Banning chemicals, shooting at vehicles, things along that.
Absolutely. So the chief announced on Tuesday during the Safe Communities Committee meeting that he even admitted that he didn't think that they would meet, you know, as of several weeks ago, that they would meet all eight criteria. But they did, and now they are among three cities, San Francisco and Tucson, Arizona, have met all eight criteria. But the larger discussion that committee is having will be coming back on September 29th with some more formal recommendations that deal with what we saw in June between protesters and officers.
So I was watching the governor's press conference yesterday about schools and other things when suddenly Joe Bruno got through to the governor with a question. And the question was, will Halloween be able to be observed this year? The governor immediately sidestepped your question and turned it over to Dr. Mandy Cohen. What did she say, Joe?
He didn't want to face the tough question about Halloween, but Dr. Cohen says that Halloween is on. Feel free to visit those former Rite Aids that are now Spirit Halloweens. Grab your costume. Guidelines to come.
Well, thank goodness for that, because I've already got my mask. Hint, hint. Uh-huh. And I need a fill-up on that candy. Joe Bruno gets the last word. He's a reporter for WSOC-TV. Nick Oxner's with WBTV. Jonathan Lowe is with Spectrum News 1. And Andos Helms with WFAE News. That's it. We're out of time. Thank you for the hour. Support comes from WFAE members and Mazda of South Charlotte, dedicated to those who believe a car should stir one's emotions and deliver a heightened state of driving. More at MazdaofSouthCharlotte.com.